This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Moorish. Orthodox. Radio. Crusade. Anarchism for the global city. Radical environmentalism for the concrete jungle. Esoteric explorations of the secret history of rebel culture. The Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Every Tuesday at midnight after the news, only on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Be there.
أين ستهربون من ردة الغضب في صدر شعب كامل يحترف الغضب بحقنا الأسير؟ أين ستهربون من لعنة الضمير؟ أين ستهربون؟ هي لعبة المصير. لا، لن يجدي الهرب. لا، لن يجدي الهرب. لن يجدي الهرب.
الدمار لبنان لن يمنحكم سلام الانكسار. في أرضه في أرضه إلا انتحار
إلا انتحار إلا انتحار
وكلنا جنوب وكلنا ثوار فكلنا حدود دماؤنا الأسوار
وكلنا جنوب وكلنا ثوار وكلنا حدود دماؤنا الأسوار
وكلنا ثوار وكلنا حدوده دماؤنا الأسوار
وكلنا جنوب وكلنا ثوار وكلنا حدوده دماؤنا الأسوار وكلنا جنوب وكلنا ثوار وكلنا حدوده دماؤنا الأسوار
وكلنا جنوب وكلنا ثوار وكلنا حدوده دماؤنا أنتم ومن وراءكم من دول القرار نحن شعب لم يعد يخيفه الدمار فالموت في حياتنا فصل من النهار وكلنا حدوده دماؤنا الأسوار
فلتسمعوا فلتسمعوا
ها نحن شعب حامل أوسمة الشهادة نموت في ترابنا ونعلن السيادة نموت في رمادنا وتعلن الولادة
All right, welcome aboard to the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade on listener-supported, non-commercial, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, where it's now almost 8 minutes after the hour being midnight, which makes it 12:08. My name is Bill Weinberg. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. We were opening up with some sounds of the Lebanese diva Majida El Rumi from her album Reza Al. And the name of that song is Kana, and it is dedicated to a village in southern Lebanon near the Israeli border of that name, Kana, which was bombed by Israeli missiles and warplanes both in 1996 and in 2005 with a pretty horrific toll in civilian casualties both times. And some of the lyrics, which have been translated by some friends of ours out on the West Coast, because in the liner notes, they're only available in Arabic and in French. But we've got a personal translation. Now we'll read some of the lyrics. Read, "We are all revolutionaries. The anger echoes in our chests. We are all the border," meaning Lebanon's border with Israel. "Where will you hide from the revolutionaries?" You meaning Israel. "You and the big decision makers standing behind you. We die for our dirt. You can't wash away that shame. We die in our blood, but we are born anew. You, Israel, the flowers of death, a culture of destruction. Lebanon won't give you peace from her defeat. Whatever you gain from our land will be your suicide. Where are you going to escape to? Where are the people? We are the people no longer afraid of destruction. There is nowhere to escape. Listen up." Wow. So sings Majida al-Rumi, which is a very clear picture of some of the emotions which are in play in that part of the world in this conflict, which has been going on for far too many generations now. And we're pleased to be joined tonight by somebody who is talking about peaceful solutions in the region on a national tour to promote her book, Witness in Palestine, a Jewish-American woman in the occupied territories. Anna Balzer, are you there?
I am. I'm glad to be here.
Welcome aboard to WBAI. So you're up in New Haven, Connecticut. Is that it tonight?
That's right. Just having returned from New London, where I gave the second talk of the evening at Connecticut College.
So you've got a very busy schedule these days, it appears.
Yes, these days. A little bit too busy, but it's going to be calming down. I'm coming into the city, New York City, tomorrow, and we'll be at Columbia Thursday evening at 8 o'clock. So I'm looking forward to that.
Right. That's why.
My alma mater.
Oh, is it really?
Yes.
Uh-huh. But you're actually living out in the Midwest these days, right?
That's right. That's where I hang my hat. But I'm not there all that much because most of my time I'm traveling around doing just this.
Uh-huh. So are you from, where are you from originally?
I'm from the California Bay Area.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then I went to school out east here in the Northeast at Columbia, and now I'm in the Midwest, so I'm sort of all over the place.
Uh-huh. And so tomorrow night you're going to be speaking up at Columbia University.
Actually, on Thursday, so Thursday night.
Thursday night.
October 16th at 8 o'clock in Hamilton Hall, yeah.
Okay, well, we'll have the opportunity to announce that again. But I just got your book in the mail, and
great.
What's that?
That's great to hear.
Yeah. Yeah, and I've been looking it over with great interest. I must say, you know, there's been an awful lot of books which have been produced about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, histories and political analyses and so on, reams and reams and reams, libraries and libraries and libraries of books. But I have to say, of all the books that I've looked at, yours really gives the clearest picture, I think, of what day-to-day life is like for the people who live in the occupied territories.
Well, thank you. My primary resource is photographs, as you can see.
Yes, there's photographs nearly every page of the book has got photographs.
And my perspective is that, I mean, myself, I was very skeptical when I first heard stories from Palestinians in Lebanon and Syria about what was happening. Not having seen it myself, it was hard to believe. And so the idea behind bringing those photographs back here is that, you know, photographs don't lie. And if people are confronted with the realities through the photographs, through the maps, I think it forces people to recognize what's happening, even if we're not getting it in our mainstream newspapers.
Mm-hmm. So your initial contacts, you say, with Palestinians were in Syria
Actually, predominantly Lebanon. I was living in Turkey at the time and was traveling through the Middle East for fun, really, I mean, to explore, and was taken in by Palestinian refugees, especially in southern Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
And it was through friendships with them that I began to hear these completely different, you know, versions of the history and present of the area. And like I said, my first reaction was disbelief. It took actually seeing it with my own eyes to believe it. So I'm trying to bring that information back. But I was very skeptical for a long time.
Well, just out of curiosity, how did you happen to wind up in Syria? Because, I mean, that's not quite as open to tourists as Lebanon.
I had, it's perfectly open to tourists. I mean, I was living in Ankara, Turkey at the time, and you went to the Syrian embassy, and my boyfriend at the time was American. He got one easily as well. I have a double citizenship with the EU. But anyway, it's really not as hard as it sounds, and it was an extraordinarily welcoming society everywhere I went through Syria, so I can't recommend it highly enough. I went there because I loved traveling, and I had backpacked around the United States, around Europe, around Asia, and I felt here I am in Turkey. I might as well go south at some point, and so it was really more because I happened to be there than any particular. I certainly wasn't politically motivated or even necessarily intellectually. I had graduated in math and economics and didn't really have much intention of doing much else besides that. And yet, when I was confronted with these things, it has become really my livelihood.
Mm-hmm. So, let's start at the beginning. You grew up in a Jewish family in the San Francisco Bay Area.
That's right.
And you actually visited Israel as a youth in some kind of Zionist youth group. What was it called again?
I actually went with Birthright Israel.
Right, Birthright
in
Israel.
In 2000. Uh-huh. Yeah, and it's really, it's a tour given, it's a sort of all-expense-paid 10-day tour provided to Jewish North Americans mostly to kind of show them the glory of Israel. It's what I would refer to as an indoctrination tour to sort of garner support for the State of Israel from Jewish Americans who might not otherwise feel that connected to it.
And so I assume to try to get them to consider Aliyah.
Yeah, consider actually going and immigrating to Israel. Certainly, I think, I mean, the follow-up programs to Birthright Israel involve a lot of encouragement of marrying other people you met on the trip, of moving there eventually. It's no secret that the intention is not simply to show a good time, but to garner support. And it is widespread support within the United States, especially of Israel, that has allowed, I think, the conflict to continue as it has for so long. So it's no secret that those favoring the status quo want to keep doing that. But I first went there and had no, nothing was shown to me to challenge my initial perception of Israel-Palestine until I stepped off of the tour bus, so to speak, and actually went into Palestinian areas. And
oh, so you did that? You did that when you were there with Birthright Israel? Back in
no, I didn't.
Right.
I had to come back to do that.
Right, that's what I would have imagined. Yes.
Yeah.
So what? Yeah. I'm just wondering what were your initial impressions back in 2000? I mean, certainly when you were there, even with this Zionist youth group, you were aware of the Palestinian conflict. What were your perceptions at the time?
I can't say that I was really aware of it. I had heard about it, but I was only very vaguely aware of it. What I found when I went to Israel with Birthright Israel was I heard very heroic stories about the past, about what is known as the War of Independence for Israel, which I now know to be what is referred to as al-Nakba, which means the catastrophe in Arabic for Palestinians, given that it was the removal of most of their population from the area. But I heard sort of heroic stories. I met soldiers. I met settlers. I saw nothing to really challenge my perceptions. And so I thought, well, this is exactly what I thought, and Israel is all that it's cracked up to be, and how wonderful. And I had a wonderful time and a lot of fun, but it in no way touched upon the conflict itself, the ongoing discrimination against non-Jewish people in the area. And when I first discovered in meeting the refugees in Lebanon, for example, when I first discovered that I was misinformed, I felt somehow kind of betrayed, that I felt like I had to go and find out the truth. And that's what made me want to go and, you know, step off the tour bus and actually go into Palestinian areas. And it's night and day. I mean, Palestinians have separate roads, separate hospitals, separate schools, et cetera. Everything is so segregated that if you spend all of your time on an Israeli tour bus, you could never have any idea what was really going on for the non-Jewish population there.
Mm-hmm. All right. So when you say step off the tour bus, in your case, you don't mean it literally. You mean it sort of metaphorically, because
That going not on a Zionist tour, but actually going there and being on the ground and actually talking to people other than the people that are there to garner support for the State of Israel.
Mm-hmm. All right. So when you were there in 2000, that was immediately before the Second Intifada, right? So I guess it was a period of relative lull when it would have been possible to somewhat ignore the conflict, perhaps. After that, it quickly became much more difficult to ignore.
I wonder whether, had it been during the Intifada itself, whether it would have been harder to ignore. But, you know, still today and throughout the Intifada when I've been there, I find that it is still possible to kind of ignore it. I mean, things are raging like wildfire in Iraq, and yet it is possible to some extent for people here to ignore what's happening. And it's all, really almost the same within Israeli society, even if the distance is, you know, 10 miles rather than 10,000 or,
yes,
or so. The segregation, for example, in my presentation, I'll talk about the wall shown from the Palestinian side versus from the Israeli side, that actually a lot of the information, even just sort of seeing what the wall looks like, what's actually happening on the ground, Israelis aren't getting. And so to some extent, I think even with the Intifada going on, I probably could have gone around and had no idea still. You know, if you're a tourist and you go to visit Bethlehem, for example, you'd go on the Israeli-only roads. You would take an Israeli-colored, yellow-colored Israeli license plate and have
or
all...
Just to make clear, Bethlehem is on the West Bank.
Exactly.
Right, so you're actually leaving Israel proper, but I imagine that plenty of tourists go there.
That's right.
And through Israel and never really see the Palestinian reality.
And even my tour with Birthright Israel went to, for example, the Dead Sea, which is also in the West Bank. We went to East Jerusalem. So these tours also involve going to the West Bank, but you would never know you were going into it because things are so integrated. And so, I mean, Israel is so assimilated into the West Bank and then things are so segregated. So, it really took going there and talking to people.
Mm-hmm. And Palestinians are pretty effectively barred from these roads.
That's right. There are exceptions. If a Palestinian can get a certain permit, they might be able to use like a certain section of a certain road, but in all other cases, the roads are segregated.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so to sort of continue with the chronology here, so what year were you teaching English, was it, in Turkey?
Yeah, I had started in 2002, and 2003 is when I first went to Lebanon and Syria. And sort of got the idea in my mind that I wanted to see things for myself. And it was in late 2003 that I went for the first time and have been back every year since. I'm getting ready to go back again, actually, early next month. So I over the years have sort of watched things progress, but my initial experiences in the occupied territories with Palestinians was in 2003.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so but the sort of turning point for you in terms of your awareness of the situation was when you were in Lebanon, sort of just as a tourist, not a political tourist, but just an ordinary tourist.
That's right. I mean, of course, it was more complex than that. It wasn't that all of a sudden I had an epiphany, but really that, I mean, my initial reaction, as most are, I just spoke at Connecticut College, and I could see, you know, a dozen people in the audience getting so angry at me because they didn't want to hear these things. They didn't want to be confronted with the reality. So when I first heard these stories of house demolitions, of explosions, of assassinations, I didn't want to believe it. I thought this is propaganda. These people are brainwashed. I thought, well, if Israel's doing anything, it's because it has to, that this is self-defense. I kind of came up with every excuse in the book to not confront what was happening. But as I heard more and more stories, as I tried to prove them wrong with research, and research only proved that they were right and I was wrong, I had to begin to confront these things. So I went through a process I think a lot of people go through of re-education, you know, of really countering all of that miseducation so many of us have been through about the Nakba being somehow voluntary, about the occupation being about security. It just doesn't make sense as soon as you do the research.
Okay, so where, just out of curiosity, what sources did you turn to for the research? Because certainly there are plenty of pro-Israel media watch organizations which exist to try to keep people from getting an actual understanding of what the actual history
right.
has been. So how did you happen to bypass that intellectual booby trap, so to speak?
Actually, it's not that hard to bypass as long as you go beyond U.S. sources. There's a fair amount of information out there when you go to European mainstream or Arab mainstream or Latin American, Asian mainstream, even Israeli mainstream media sources. So actually I found the information, especially with the internet, wasn't too hard to come by. I just had to go beyond U.S. mainstream sources to also to U.S. alternative media sources like Democracy Now!, which I know plays on WBAI and other programs like that. But I went first. I remember going to Israeli media. I thought, well, certainly the Israeli media is not anti-Semitic. We're talking about Israeli mainstream society here. And I found that within Israel, there is so much more discussion about this issue than we find here in this country. And I thought, well, that's odd. In fact, the majority of Israelis are very against this occupation that I am so desperately trying to defend. So first of all, that was an introduction. I looked at Israeli human rights organizations. I still had it in my head that somehow unless Israelis and unless Jewish people said it was so, that I kind of couldn't believe it. So I was really, you know, that was a level of racism on my part that I felt it meant more coming from a Jewish person. And that's racism that I deal with all the time, that I'm invited actually even today, you know, to tell Palestinian stories where the Palestinians themselves aren't invited. But I was where I was, and I needed to hear it from certain people to believe it. So as I read Israeli human rights groups reports, as I read Israeli newspapers, as I read human rights reports from other human rights groups like Amnesty and Human Rights Watch, I began to be more open to hearing people's stories of people coming back from Palestine. A wonderful woman, Ora Wise, there in New York City, spoke with me at length and helped me, I think, a little bit through that racism. Having just gotten back from Palestine, she recommended groups I might work with to kind of ease me into it, but it was just what I needed. So essentially it was a very kind of long process of preparing myself and of finally being ready to be open enough to see everything there. And I'm still evolving, you know, I'm still learning and changing in different ways, and trying to counter bits of racism, that I want to believe are gone, but they're always there. I mean, we all have these complexities that we have to work through, these filters of miseducation. So I continue, really.
Okay, so in what context did you wind up returning to the region and actually going to the West Bank and the occupied territories explicitly as an observer and as an activist? How did that come to pass?
That came about when I had finally made the decision to go to Palestine and see things for myself, and I happened to go to a report back in Boulder, Colorado, at which a young woman, Nadia, was speaking. And when I mentioned that I was thinking of going, she recommended that I might look up the International Women's Peace Service. And it was just the right recommendation. In fact, IWPS was, I think, just the right group for me to join. It's an organization based in the West Bank that documents human rights abuses in the area and supports Palestinian-led nonviolent resistance to the occupation. And I went there not knowing very much, but they were kind enough to offer me a short-term position there as a volunteer. And I went and we did everything from accompanying farmers to their olive groves to going to demonstrations to helping farmers pick out poison from their land when settlers came and poisoned it. We kind of did every day something different. And I was so moved by what I was witnessing and shocked by it that I felt like I had to write it down and I had to tell at least my family, my friends. And what I found when I sent the information out to my community was that it spread like wildfire. I mean, people were joining my email list. People were, you know, wanting to know more. And I thought, actually, there is a demand for this information. It's not that Americans simply don't want to know, but that they are desperate for the realities, for the truth about this. And so eventually I decided to put these writings into a book and have been traveling around more or less ever since mid-2005 and early 2006, telling people these stories. And what I find is that the more places I go, the more interest there is, the more people want to hear these things. So it's actually a privilege because I'm able to sort of connect with the movement all over the country and see the way it actually is growing, the way people want this information, the way things are changing slowly but surely. And And another testimony to that is being in Palestine and watching the movement grow there and the extraordinary resilience of the people there in spite of all of this.
Okay, it's mere seconds of 12:30 in the morning on listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York City. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. I'm Bill Weinberg, and we are speaking by telephone with Anna Baltzer. Am I pronouncing your name correctly, Anna?
Exactly right, Bill.
Good, glad to hear it. And her book is Witness in Palestine, A Jewish American Woman in the Occupied Territories. I should say that it is available from Paradigm Publishers in Boulder, Colorado. And the reason that we're speaking to you by phone in New Haven is because you're on your way down to New York City tomorrow. You're going to be speaking at Columbia University Thursday night, right?
That's exactly right, at 8 o'clock in Hamilton Hall. And let me give my website, because the details for my different events are on the website, as well as my book can be purchased from there, as well as my DVD of my presentation. People can sign my list, all kinds of stuff. Or you can write me if you have a response to the show. Anyway, the email, the website is www.annainthemiddleeast.com. So that's A-N-N-A in the Middle East, all one word. com. And again, there you can check out the schedule. I'll be in New York City as well as up in Kingston in the Hudson Valley. I'll be down in at Princeton. I'll be in New Jersey and in Philadelphia, all over the place. So if you're listening and you're interested, feel free to get all the details at annainthemiddleeast.com and see if you can't make it to one of them.
All right. Well, you'll have the opportunity to announce that again. Did you have did you take most of the photos in the book?
Yeah, the majority of them.
Wow, very impressive. So,
like I said, the photos really tell the whole story. And in my presentations, I don't sort of tell people what to think. I don't editorialize. I simply describe what's happening in these photos and allow people to come to their own conclusions. And it's so stark. I mean, the segregation, the discrimination, that people generally are smart enough to see that there's something terribly wrong here and that they don't want to be involved paying tax dollars, et cetera.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of the details of that. Why don't you give us a bit of a travelogue through the West Bank and some of the places you visited and how exactly people are being deprived of, you know, villages are being deprived of their ancestral lands and people are living under this system of extremely rigid military control.
Well, I can talk about some of the structures of that military control because they really make up what defines daily life for Palestinians. One of the main structures are checkpoints, which are basically places where people are screened as they move around. Unlike border crossings, which are usually located, you know, between the borders of countries or between territories, these are located not between Palestinians and Israelis, but actually between Palestinian towns and villages, which means that getting from your neighborhood to another neighborhood in the same city or from your village to the nearest town can, instead of taking 5 minutes that it would take if you just were able to drive there easily, it will take 5-10 hours even, because you'll be constantly stopped and made to wait. And so what this does is really contribute to the gradual breakdown of Palestinian society, that things simply cannot function when people can't move around. People are unable to hold a steady job, to go to school, to get to the hospital. I have a lot of stories in my book and in my experiences with IWPS interviewing women going that went into labor at checkpoints in the middle of the night that were closed at night. They couldn't reach a hospital. Their twin newborn babies died because they couldn't get to an incubator. Kids dying of asthma attacks, very preventable things, simply because they can't move around. So one major institution is simply to sort of immobilize the Palestinian population. And along with the checkpoints, you have roadblocks that are placed on Palestinian roads that prevent Palestinians from using their vehicles on their roads. So they're not manned by soldiers. It doesn't prevent anyone from crossing, even if they had a weapon with them. It simply means that you cannot use your cars on your roads. So you have to end up walking long distances, let's say walking to the hospital instead of being able to drive there in your car, walking to work instead of driving there, and rendering everything much more either time-consuming or expensive than it otherwise would be. So again, contributing to the breakdown of society. You have the wall, the so-called security fence, which is a barrier, not again between Palestinians and Israelis, but actually built largely within the Palestinian West Bank, so separating Palestinian farmers from their land, children from their schools, people from hospitals, and the wall itself, partially a 25-foot concrete wall, partially fence reinforced with razor wire, electric sensory wire, thermal imaging, and other things. This wall is indeed separating people from their livelihoods, as well as cutting off Palestinians from major water sources and from the city of Jerusalem, which is holy not just for Jewish people, but also for the Muslims and Christians in the area. You have all of these different structures, and each of them contribute to, you know, if you're a Palestinian person, and let's say you're a child, you're thinking about what you want to be. You know, there's no options. There's no ability to function as a normal human being under these circumstances. And to make matters worse, you know, let's say that you happen to have a plot of land and you may or may not be able to get to it, but the next thing you know, there's a caravan that's been set up on your land, and people from Israel are planting an Israeli flag in the middle of it and saying, now this is our land.
Or now, what do you mean by a caravan?
Well, these are what are called outposts. So, essentially, groups of Israelis will actually come into the occupied territories and plant themselves down. They'll come even in the middle of the night and declare simply, this is now our land. These are called outposts. And according to international law and even Israeli law, these outposts are illegal, but the Israeli government doesn't do anything to prevent them from coming. Palestinians are not allowed to have weapons and are largely defenseless, given that the settler population, the settlers, the Israelis moving into these areas, tend to be very heavily armed. And so over time, what you have is a caravan that was brought there illegally in the middle of the night.
Oh, no, you're using caravan in the British sense, I take it, of a sort of like a trailer camp?
Exactly. Thanks for clarifying. Mm-hmm. We're talking about sort of a series of trailers.
Yes.
And these trailers will kind of, there will be more and more of them. Eventually they build buildings. And what you find is that, there comes to be these actual towns and cities built illegally on Palestinian land. These, you know, places, this is somebody's backyard or somebody's livelihood. They're olive trees. There's this new city, new town built, and it's exclusively for Jewish Israelis. So what that means is that I, as a Jewish person, since I could become Israeli, I could go and I could live in one of these Jewish-only towns in the West Bank on Palestinian land, and yet the farmers and families who own the land that these settlements are built on are not allowed to live in them because they're Christian or they're Muslim, because they're not Jewish.
If you were going to live there, I mean, you would have to make aliyah. You would have to become an Israeli citizen and so on.
I would have to become an Israeli, which I have no intention
right.
of doing.
Right.
But the idea that somehow, because of my ethnic or religious background, I should have more rights to a place than people who've been living there for generations, is something so there's something so inherently problematic about that Israel and its settlements are not for the citizens of Israel, but rather for a specific ethnic religious group. And for me, it's paramount to, if you had a state of the Christian white people, you know, what would that mean to have a state that's based on ethnic and religious ties.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that on a certain level, that is very, very much the subtext of the current presidential election in this country.
Yeah, actually, we might argue that it is very much the already the reality, but certainly not formally, at least.
Right. Officially, it's not. I think in some sense, it's sort of a separate conversation, but I think in some sense, the current presidential election is a referendum on that very issue. So,
yeah, good point.
Interesting to see which way it goes. But I'd like to hear more about the actual mechanics of how some of these farming villages, which you visited on the West Bank, are being deprived of their ancestral lands which have been farmed by the residents of these villages for centuries. And just in the past generation, or not even, just in the past 5 years, these lands have been cut off from the villages by this whole security system, which has come along with the so-called wall.
Right. Security system in quotes, of course, because in my opinion, if you want to build a wall between, you know, to separate Palestinians from Israelis, you don't build it between Palestinians and Palestinians. Let's talk about the specifics. It's just village after village, but one village of Masha, for example, a village in the West Bank that's been cut off from 90% of the village is now on the other side of the wall. So you have the built-up area of the village where the people live, and then you have the entire surroundings of the village that are the farmlands, the areas that people in the village live off of. And so in building the wall, rather than building it again on the green line, the border between the West Bank and present-day Israel, Israel in this case, for example, built it as close as possible to the Palestinian built-up area of Masha, so that all of the surrounding area of Masha ended up on the Israeli side. And so what that means is that farmers are no longer able to get to their land, or getting there is now extremely difficult, and people have no more means of sustaining themselves. One family in particular, a woman named Munir, a friend of mine, and her family, their house was unfortunately for them a little bit outside of the built-up area of Masha, and so in building the wall, they were too far outside of the built-up area to be included on the Palestinian side of the wall, on Masha, the built-up area side of the wall, and so they're kind of stuck on the wrong side of the wall, separated from their community, and yet since they are, if people are able to visualize this, so if you imagine a village and the built-up area, and a house that's away from the built-up area, and the wall being built right in between the built-up area and the one house. Well, since that one house is now on the, quote, Israeli side, it is exposed to settlements, et cetera. And so the Israeli government has actually built another wall behind their house, and then two more walls on either side of it, so that they're living in a cage, basically, of just their house, to separate them from the settlers behind them, separating them from their community of Masha, separating them from their land and their livelihood. And what's so remarkable to me is that this family, in spite of all odds, are still there, that they are insisting on staying in their home, even though there's such tremendous pressure for them to leave, for them to go and live with the other people from Masha. They are intent on staying in their home. It's their right. It should be their right. And so for me, it's both a story of tragedy, but also of it's hope inspiring to me, of incredible resilience.
Okay, so how, in fact, do they manage in a position like this? How one thinks that they want to, get to their lands, where they, what do they do on their lands? Do they grow olives? Do they herd goats?
Yes, usually they grow olives. Yeah.
All right. So if they need to go tend their olive trees, they're going to have to go through. They're going to go through the wall, and if they're going,
that's right.
And if they're going to go to the village center to do some shopping or to see friends or have a cup of coffee, they're going to have to go through the wall.
Exactly.
So what are the mechanics of getting through the wall? How much of a barrier is this?
Well, when I was last there, and that was about a year ago, the army was allowing them control over their gate in the wall for specific times of the day. And so they were able to open one part of their cage, the one going into their village, at certain parts of the day. And so they would go there to go shopping, et cetera, like you were mentioning. One problem, however, is that a lot of times I've found the family is actually hesitant to leave the house alone, and that is because Israel, as it has to tens of thousands of other Palestinian homes, could very well demolish their home. That actually most families aren't lucky enough really to have a cage built around them. Most of the time Israel doesn't bother building a cage, but rather will actually demolish homes that are in the way of expansion. And so there's even a fear of leaving the house that comes along with all of this. But they have found a way to sustain themselves. I don't know quite how they do it. I know that they are able to leave just enough maybe to sustain themselves very sort of minimally. And I don't know whether they have also received support from others who feel that their story is somewhat representative of Palestinians insisting on staying in their homes and needing support to do so, lest they be completely removed from the area.
Okay, so you say that they have freedom to pass through the gate at certain times of day, but not others.
Yes.
So do they have to carry some kind of a special pass to get in and out?
No, there's a soldier there. There's a soldier there. Mm-hmm. So the soldier would be in charge of that, would allow them at certain times.
Okay, but there are also certain times of day when they're essentially trapped on this little patch of land, which is caged in on all sides.
And that's really the case for so many Palestinians that you know, if you decide to go to the other side, to go to your land, who knows when you'll get back? I mean, it's so unpredictable, and it's so unpredictable, really, that people cannot sort of reasonably sustain themselves, because you never know when it's going to take you 10 hours to get to work and you won't be able to get home to your family. You never know these things. And so again, it's, you know, people find ways here and there to make money, but with this institution itself, there's no way of kind of reliably sustaining oneself. And that's why, you know, addressing these issues is so urgent, especially for us here in the U.S., given that it's our taxpayers, it's our tax dollars paying for it.
So how long has this particular family been in this situation?
It was, I believe, in 2003 in the summertime. Actually, there was a whole Mashhad camp that was set up of Israelis and Palestinians and internationals who came to the village of Mashhad and actually camped out together in protest of the wall that was coming, that was not yet built, so that is now built. But and they camped out specifically in front of Munira and her family's home, knowing in anticipation of the wall being built between them and their community. And so it was in the summer of 2003 that after several months of Israelis, internationals, and Palestinians coexisting harmoniously in cooperation with each other in this Palestinian village, the army came, arrested dozens of activists, and began to build this wall. And the wall has been there ever since. So now we're talking about more than 5 years that they've been living there in this cage.
Mm-hmm. And the people who were arrested at this encampment were Palestinians, Israelis, and internationals, all three?
I know for a fact there were Israelis and internationals, and mm-hmm. I don't know whether there were Palestinians, but I would imagine there were.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In addition to the sort of official harassment and cutting people off from their lands via the military and the wall, there's also the sort of unofficial campaign of settler violence and attacks on the farmers. Why don't you tell us about what you call in one chapter the twisted Easter egg hunt?
Yeah, well, in one case, this was actually down in Hebron, in the south of the West Bank, where villagers who have been struggling to stay on their land. When I mentioned those trailers, those caravans coming and asserting themselves on land, what happens is that villagers losing their land oftentimes are forced to flee, forced to go elsewhere. And so villages like this particular one of Atawani are struggling to stay on their land.
Now, this is south of Hebron?
It is south of Hebron, yeah, just mm-hmm. south of it. And so one of the ways that settlers, the Israelis who are coming in to take the land, and I should point out that the majority of Israelis don't support these particular settlers' actions. The majority, this is a minority of Israelis who are ultra-Orthodox, very fundamentalist Zionist Jews. Anyway, they, in an effort to prevent Palestinians in the village from going to their land and to really encourage them to stop going and eventually maybe to leave their land, the settlers actually came down. They had boiled barley seeds in rat poison, and they actually spread the poison around the landscape of around the land of Atawani, so that shepherds bringing their sheep there, the sheep would be killed, and many were. The water was poisoned, and there were all sorts of other repercussions. Anyway, this was written up, by the way, all over the Israeli press and internationally, but was, as far as I know, not mentioned here in the United States. Anyway, in reaction to this, this poisoning, the Palestinian village, again, rather than sort of giving up hope, being extraordinarily resilient in my perspective, invited internationals and Israelis to come to film what was happening, to document it, and to, along with them, side by side, to actually try and pick out this poison. Of course, we knew that we couldn't get all of it, but the idea was also very symbolic, that we were showing the settlers that it wasn't acceptable, that the world was watching, and that this was that no matter how many times they poison, we will keep coming back to try and remove the poison. So we actually put on masks and gloves and had to pick out these tiny little pellets, these sort of bright turquoise pellets from the land, and it was Easter weekend, and so we thought it was sort of like an Easter egg hunt, but of course not at all at the same time.
Now, why were they bright turquoise?
I guess that's the color of the rat poison. I don't know. I have never boiled barley seeds in rat poison.
Eek.
Yeah, no, it's not funny stuff, but you know, there are always different ways of seeing it. I mean, to me, the fact that the farmers reacted by doing an action like this, and the publicity that it's received, and the fact that, you know, people reading about these things are all the more motivated to take part. I mean, the movement is growing. It seems sort of the worse things get, the more the movement does grow, and so, I continue to have hope. I know it's easy for me to say as a person of privilege. I am up against a lot less than Palestinians saying the same stuff. But to me, I see hope in spite of these kinds of stories.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to hear more about the movement which is building in response to this. But first, I'd like to hear a bit more about some of the other things which are going on in these villages. You write about attacks on crops, particularly olive trees, being burned and uprooted.
Yeah, that's a big issue. More than a million olive fruit trees have been uprooted, especially for the wall. And again, you know, these aren't just kind of trees, these are people's livelihoods. And for example, once we got a call at 10 at night that that olive trees were being uprooted in a nearby village of Marda. And we immediately took a taxi to get there and got there, and the soldiers were just uprooting the tree after tree. We asked them why, and they said that there had been kids throwing stones at settler cars, and so this was the punishment. And this is every day. I mean, they had come into this village, they're uprooting, you know, 75 years of work of a particular family in the village, having nothing to do probably with those boys who may or may not have been throwing stones. And so anyway, the family who owned these olive trees that were uprooted in collective punishment for the alleged stone throwing, when we talked to them about this, we had received a call from someone working for an Israeli human rights group that said that the Israeli government, unlike usual, was actually willing to pay compensation for this uprooting of the trees. And when we went to this family to tell them that there was a possibility of being compensated for the trees, they looked at us like we were crazy. They said, you can't compensate somebody for trees. You know, trees are our history. The trees are future. Trees are present livelihood.
So they actually refused. They refused the compensation.
They refused the compensation.
Mm-hmm.
And this was actually in retrospect not too surprising, because it has happened before, and it goes that trees for many Palestinians are almost kind of a part of a family, and so when we think of the millions of trees, I wish I remembered if it was 1 or 2 million, but it's certainly a lot. Being uprooted for the wall and for other parts of the occupation, it is tragic.
Okay, and then in addition to the trees which have been sort of officially uprooted by the security forces to make way for the wall and for punitive measures, There's also attacks on trees and crops by the settlers, which are officially illegal but carried out with impunity, I understand.
Exactly, exactly. And actually, one example of not only trees being under attack, but an entire agricultural area was in the village of Wadikana, which is a small village near where I was living. It's in a valley, and it's surrounded by several hilltops, all of which are crowned with an Israeli settlement. And the Israeli settlements for many years were directing their sewage down the hills into this valley, where there had once been a Palestinian village that, being essentially covered with raw sewage, eventually they had to evacuate the area. And when I first went to Wadikana, it was, first of all, unbearable smell-wise. It was disgusting. It was a valley that had once had actually a fresh water source there, which is very precious there in the desert. And instead it was a stream of urine and feces. It was, it had been abandoned by its inhabitants. Again, you know, becoming refugees. So many of the Palestinians living in occupation are already refugees from 1948. So once again being displaced, the destruction of the land itself. I mean, not only through the uprooting of olive trees, but poisoning the land, but, you know, covering it with sewage. I mean, it's hard to imagine, given that the claim is somehow that Jewish people have more of a connection to the land. This is the claim of the ideological settlers, thinking that this is only belonging to Jewish people. And yet we see the actions of settlers so disrespectful, really, of the land and so unknowledgeable about what the effects, the long-term effects, really, on the environmental long-term effects are of their actions.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I have one more question before we move on to sort of the activist response to all of this, which you've been a part of. You mentioned the house demolitions. Now, these have been carried out, to my understanding, both to make way for the wall and for security purposes and for punitive purposes, to punish families who are believed to harbor militants or even just stone throwers. But there aren't, so to speak, merely arbitrary house demolitions which are carried out in the same sense that there have been, just arbitrary, like sort of de facto, settler attacks on crops.
I mean, I actually don't know the answer to that. I have the impression that there have been arbitrary house demolitions, simply because there are so many cases of Palestinians having no warning and suddenly their house being demolished. But I would actually go to the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions,
yes,
ICAD, to find out for sure. But actually the punitive house demolitions, it was several years ago now that the Israeli court actually found that, through research, that punitive demolitions were not, in any way effective, that it didn't somehow, that punishing the entire family of someone who committed a violent act against Israel or Israelis, did not seem to deter violence. In fact, if anything, it promoted more of it. And, you know, this may be surprising in the case of Israel-Palestine, but let's take another example. You know, would we, for example, in the case of Timothy McVeigh, in response to the actions of Timothy McVeigh, did we go and demolish the house of Timothy McVeigh's sister and mother and father and
right
husband?
Well, you see, this is the thing. All right, so let me ask you: after this court ruling, did the punitive demolitions in fact stop?
Well, that's the thing. No, they haven't. No, they haven't. But they are, I think, as far as I know, they're less in number. But this is actually not at all my specialty. Most of the house demolitions are happening down in the Jerusalem area, and I was in the rural area of Salfit in the north of the West Bank.
Mm-hmm.
But as you said, I believe it is true, that the majority of them are really to make way for this expansion. So that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, this is the thing which always amazes me about the situation, is that, there actually is ostensibly an independent judiciary in Israel, and activists and human rights groups are always challenging these sorts of abuses in the courts, and not always, but at least sometimes the courts have ruled the right way. And yet this whole horrible situation continues, and as an actual system which is being imposed of, you know, land theft and this kind of draconian control of movement and so on, it really hasn't been lifted at all. That's the sort of thing which confuses me about the situation.
I was speaking recently to Ilan Pape, the wonderful Israeli historian, about this, and I was talking about sort of improvements to the situation, and he said, you know, Anna, and I do know this, but I was kind of hoping for something else. He said, you know, you cannot. There's only so much that you can improve an inherently racist system, and that you know, it is true that there are certain cases that are ruled in favor of Palestinians in the Israeli courts, but this is all within a framework of Zionism, a framework of preference for one particular ethnic or religious group over another. And so to me, the ways in which Israel tries to improve itself or not, and the way that Israelis oftentimes are working to be as nice as possible to Palestinians within an ethnocentric nationalist framework, are sort of doomed to failure, no matter how well-intentioned the people in the courts or the people advocating for Palestinian rights. So I think there is sort of short-term value in these court cases, but it's no surprise to me that they don't ultimately fix things, because they are not ultimately addressing the inherent issue, the underlying issue, the catalyst for all of the conflict and violence, and that is the Judaization of a land where the majority of people with rights to it are not Jewish, are Muslim, are Christian. And then until that is actually addressed, it's kind of hard to put Band-Aids over over things that...
Yes, well, addressing it is a pretty tricky question, but I'd like to move on to that a little bit next. I should say that we're... It's 1 o'clock in the morning on listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. I'm Bill Weinberg, and we're speaking with Anna Baltzer, who is the author of Witness in Palestine, a Jewish-American Woman in the Occupied Territories, which is available from Paradigm Publishers in Boulder, Colorado. You're going to be speaking once again Thursday night at... Columbia University, what time and where again?
It's at 8 o'clock in Hamilton Hall, 8 p.m. in Hamilton Hall. And all the details for this and my other events are on my website, annainthemiddleeast.com. Again, it's A-N-N-A in the Middle East.com, all one word. And on there you can find my upcoming events at Columbia this Thursday at 8 o'clock in Hamilton Hall, as well as elsewhere in the Northeast. Mm-hmm. You can also find my book there. It's actually cheaper than elsewhere. My book, my DVD. You can contact me if you have comments about this show. And again, see details about the events.
Okay, so I'd like to hear a bit more about the movement which is coming together, which is actually bringing together Palestinians, Israelis, and international activists such as yourself to, at a minimum, to witness, as is the title of your book, Witness in Palestine, but also to actually sometimes blockade or obstruct nonviolently these sorts of military activities and so on the West Bank. So what are some of the structures and groups and politics of this movement which is bringing these people together to try to provide some resistance here?
Well, I mean, there's so many. I don't know where to begin. I can say that in general there, I think, is a growing understanding that it's not enough simply to be against the occupation. I mean, most Israelis are, but it doesn't mean the end of the occupation any more than most Americans being against the Iraq War means that the Iraq War ends. And so anyway, there's a sense that it takes more than that, that it's actually going there, for example, going and supporting Palestinians, putting your bodies on the line as well, marching alongside Palestinians and stepping out of your comfort zone. That is part of what makes change eventually happen. So you see groups like Anarchists Against the Wall in Israel, groups of young people especially going, many of whom identify as anarchists, but some who don't, going into the occupied territories to support nonviolent Palestinian protests, for example. Many of them are tear gassed, are beaten, but they continue. Now I'm talking about the Israeli involvement in particular, but there's of course much more not involving Israelis as well. You have a lot of Israelis going, for example, into the territories to support Palestinians, planting olive trees, picking olives, simply going to their land, knowing that with an Israeli or an international presence there, there's simply a smaller chance that that violence will be used against those Palestinians. And so anyway, you have people coming in basically to accompany and for accompaniment as well as support in protest. There's so many different ways coming in and documenting at the checkpoints what's happening, getting the stories back to Israelis, to the international community. And that's the Israeli movements that I'm talking about, but by and large, the most resistance is happening by Palestinians themselves and in all different ways. And people like to talk about the protests, and certainly those are happening all the time, but there are more sort of non-traditional forms of resistance happening as well.
What do you mean by non-traditional?
I guess what I mean is what things that we wouldn't necessarily think of as resistance. So one example to me would be Munira's decision to stay in her house. For me, Munira's decision to stay in her house, to say, no, you're not going to take my house away. You've taken my freedom, you've taken my land, but you're not going to take my home. To me, that is a kind of resistance. And when we look at the land transfer in this area and see the way Palestinians, much like American Indians in this country, by the way, went from controlling expanses of land to being contained in these smaller Bantustans and islands and enclaves, that in many ways simply remaining there is a kind of resistance, preventing the complete cleansing of the land of this particular ethnic and religious group, is a kind of resistance. I talk about school children that wake up at 3:30 in the morning because they have to go through two checkpoints and a wall to get to school, but they still do it. You know, they insist on getting education. They refuse to let the occupation prevent them from being educated. Mm-hmm. And Palestinians remain some of the most educated people in the Middle East. You know, this to me is resistance. And there's so many different kinds of resistance that we don't hear about, or maybe that we don't even think about. There's resistance such as civil disobedience, refusing to carry ID cards, boycotts, strikes throughout Palestinian history, all kinds of resistance. And what I see growing on the ground in particular, though, is that collaboration between Palestinians and Israelis to an extent that sometimes I wonder how much international involvement is useful compared to in the past, because now more and more Israelis are taking on the roles international used to play in accompaniment and in solidarity. So all of these things. And by the way, in addition, my work here in this country, you know, going from place to place and meeting people involved in the movement and people so dedicated, it reminds me that it is growing and that people are anxious to do what they can. And the real struggle is what exactly to tell them would be the best thing. And we in the movement remain fragmented enough that we are not really able to speak with one voice and to assert ourselves, I think, as much as really our opposition has. And that's a challenge to us to be not only as numerous and as wealthy, which may or may not be possible, but as organized as people on the other side.
Indeed. There's a picture in your book, which shows, Palestinian protest approaching an Israeli military checkpoint with olive branches in their hands. And it reminds me very much of the famous picture of the anti-war marchers in Washington putting flowers in the barrels of the MPs down at the Pentagon in 1968 or whenever it was.
Yeah.
And it occurs to me that when there's a suicide bombing, it makes global headlines and the whole world knows about it. Meanwhile, this kind of resistance is ongoing on, I would assume, a more or less daily basis.
That's
and
right.
Very few people know about it in the outside world.
That's right. That's exactly right. And that's one of the things we have to counter, because, you know, I talk about the civilians killed in the conflict that we have, or total people killed in the conflict that, you know, last year, for example, 13 Israelis were killed, about half of them soldiers. And in the same period of time, 373 Palestinians were killed. And I talk about how precisely every single one of those Israelis that was killed was mentioned in the news, sometimes day after it happened, and how many of those 373 Palestinians were killed. So, you know, in the same way that so much of what's happening, whether it's nonviolent resistance, whether it's attacks on civilians, whatever it may be, is simply not covered in our media, and that's really our challenge with programs like WBAI and others across the country to get out what's otherwise not being told to us.
Okay, but you did actually meet with Hamas supporters in your time on the West Bank. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, I met with it, not sort of formally Hamas officials, but everyday people who feel that Hamas presents more an alternative to Fatah, with which they're generally disillusioned. And you know, really the way that I see groups like Hamas, I mean, the context here is that Fatah, which has been in power should be in quotes, by the way, given that the Palestinian Authority doesn't really have any authority at all, given the way that occupation forces undermine it so much. But there are many Palestinians that felt that Fatah had was corrupt in its use of money, for example, and they wanted to vote for a new party to come in. They voted for Hamas. Hamas being not only an organization that had a history of providing medical, for example, aid, education, school, that was a really a service-oriented organization. This is separate from its paramilitary wing. Anyway, they felt that Hamas was a good alternative, essentially, to Fatah. Not only, I think, in terms of efficiency or lack of corruption, but generally as really an alternative to this Western imperialist model that's being shoved down their throats.
Okay, what do you mean by that exactly?
I mean that kind of, you know, we see that more and more people in the Middle East are favoring more Islamic political groups, let's say. I mean, I lived in Turkey for 3 years, and I saw the way that a generally secular society is more and more supportive of Islamic groups. And I think the reason is clear that, or I guess I shouldn't oversimplify it, but I think one big reason is, you know, that watching the way these countries, with response to these, to imperialism are, becoming more and more Western. And there's a sense that they want to preserve some of their history, some of their own culture, and Islam, for, you know, whatever you think about it. I mean, it's a religion for which I have great respect, is an alternative model for society, for relationships. I mean, I'm feeling uncomfortable describing this because, you know, I'm an outsider, and so I can only speculate in terms of Palestinian reasons for supporting Hamas. But my take on it has been that it's not that somehow Palestinians that support Hamas, it's because they're violent people or because they hate Jews or something. But not at all. But that they're looking for some glimmer of hope, and they haven't gotten it from past leadership, and they're also looking to preserve themselves and their own people, and not simply have to take on so much of the culture, of the products, of every aspect of life that, since Palestine is so dependent, since Palestinians are so dependent on Israel, especially economically, sort of Palestine takes on more and more characteristics of Israel and the Western world. And I think that's something Palestinians are aware of and want to have a choice in the matter. And so this is one way of asserting
I would like
choice.
To think that the only two alternatives are not, on one hand, imperialism and globalization and the corporate monoculture, and on the other hand, political Islam and fundamentalism. I'd like to think
there's
another choice there, at least.
Sure, but the question of whether that choice is being presented to them, and you know, Israel actually was initially very supportive of Hamas as an alternative as alternative to Fatah. So perhaps these being the only two alternatives presented is no coincidence. It's no coincidence.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, as I lose my train of thought, I have to say this is my fourth event of the day. And,
yes. No. You're doing great.
Voice.
You're doing great.
But I'm gonna have to say goodbye. I'm really honored that you had me on the show, and I hope listeners will be able to come, for example, on Thursday to Columbia at 8 o'clock.
All right. Could I ask you just a couple more questions?
Yeah, I'm losing my voice though, so let's do them quick.
All right, okay. Well, for starters, the point I wanted to try to get at in terms of your meetings with Hamas is that not all Hamas supporters are necessarily what we might call rejectionist, quote unquote.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they were my friends. They were everyday people who wanted to try out a new leadership and. You know, you can what you want of Hamas, but Hamas was never actually given the opportunity to try out that leadership. So, absolutely, that's very true.
Mm-hmm. So, and what I mean by they're not rejectionist is that they're not opposed to the notion of a just coexistence with Israelis.
Yeah, and it actually, if you look, Hamas's platform itself has shifted somewhat, and Hamas now has publicly stated that it would be willing to adopt a sort of
long-term truce.
Ceasefire.
Yes.
Yeah, truce mm-hmm. with Israel. So in essence, basically, whether or not they ideologically think it's a good idea to have an ethno-nationalist state of Israel, they're willing to live with it. Israel, however, has dismissed this, as they did the offer of the Arab League to having peaceful and normal relations if they simply would comply with international law. But this is so far outside of their interest that it's been simply wiped off the table. But absolutely, yeah, Hamas supporters and even Hamas leadership have not proven to be all rejectionists.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what do you say to the argument that the wall is effective and that, in fact, suicide attacks are down since the wall has been going up? What's your response?
This is very common, and I actually had it tonight at the talk at Connecticut College. Well, I talk about, first of all, the reality of where the wall is. So the wall is not completed. The wall is a series of sections here and there. So it's not that you cannot get to the other side of the wall. It's that it requires a tremendous detour. It's certainly a big pain to get across, but but you can. And anyone who's been there will tell you you can. When I can't get into Nablus, I go around and I climb over the mountain to get into Nablus.
And yet, the suicide bombings have decreased since the wall has been going up. Not necessarily that there's a cause and effect relationship there, but it is the case.
Well, it may be the case. I actually think it has more to do with Gaza. So the majority of suicide attacks were originating in Gaza. And so with Gaza being completely sealed off, there simply is not the ability of anyone to move out. Essentially, now that you've taken the settler population as well, the settlers who had been targets sometimes of these attacks are simply not there anymore. So what we find is that the Palestinians in Gaza are completely sealed off from the outside world. And by the way, I mean, we're not just sealing off terrorists. These are everyday people who are being deprived of adequate food, of medical supplies, electricity, all kinds of things, living in essentially an open air prison in the Gaza Strip. The fact that now people are unable to get out, the new chosen form of violent resistance has been rockets. And this is a very predictable response, let's say. You can think of it what you will, but it's certainly predictable. And if you want to actually get to the end of not just suicide bombs, but of violent attacks, you have to look at the sources of those attacks and the origins of them and when have Palestinians reacted in this way. And like other peoples around the world who have resorted to terrorism, again, without making judgments on it, but purely looking from a scientific perspective of when has this happened and what are the circumstances, and they come up in very predictable scenarios where people are living under this kind of an oppressive regime and are not allowed the luxuries of having a sophisticated army and therefore resort to guerrilla tactics. If you really want to if you really want to end the guerrilla tactics, you have to look at the underlying injustices that create the circumstances pushing people towards these tactics. And if Israel is really serious about ending terrorism, it will have to look at these origins. And the origins, unfortunately for Israel, include the creation of a state that excludes Muslims and Christians in the area, that it will never be sustainable for Israel to simply be in an area, assert itself as a Jewish state, and yet most of the people with rights there aren't Jewish and are therefore not represented. This is an unsustainable concept. And so again, you can put whatever, if the wall is the new chosen Band-Aid, and maybe in some ways in certain areas for some reason deter things here and there, ultimately it is not a sustainable solution.
Well, we could also point out that it's the position of the World Court that even if we want to concede Israel's right to build a wall, it has to build that wall along its own legal boundary and not within
right.
the occupied territories.
Exactly.
But you've actually touched on the more fundamental issue, which leads me to the final question, which I wanted to ask you, which is, in your estimation, whither Zionism? I mean, you sort of started out in life with more or less Zionist assumptions, it seems.
Right.
And you've come to be consciously anti-Zionist.
Right.
So how do you perceive some kind of a way forward here, which is going to protect the rights and dignity of both Palestinians and Jews in the Holy Land?
Well, first, before I'll tell you my perspective, but I have to preface it with saying that it isn't my decision, and so I don't really see my role so much as dictating what the final solution will be, but rather first of all, publicizing what is being done with our tax dollars,
right.
trying to change, U.S. policy, really looking at where I fit into this.
Right.
But I am also someone who can have, opinions about the future of this conflict.
Exactly.
I think the two-state solution, as has been advocated for so long, of having one state for Jews and one state for Palestinians, essentially, is problematic. This is very much because I am anti-Zionist to say it, that there is something problematic about having a state in which rights depend on your ethnicity or your religion. The way that that Israeli professor and historian Ilan Pape puts it is really, if you look at the entire area, they are already living in one country. I mean, you have Jews in the Palestinian territories, in the settlements. You have Palestinians in the Jewish state. 20% of the Israeli population is Palestinian. They're all living under the control of one government, that is the Israeli government. What would it look like if you removed the system of segregation and separation? And so for me, for many people, this can be a very scary idea. People attached to the Zionist ideal of having an exclusively Jewish state, and I say exclusively in that it's the state not of citizens or not of Palestinians and Jews, but the state of the Jewish people and only that. It's a scary idea to integrate, to give equal rights, but it does open up the door to democracy, and I have to say that seems to me the most sustainable solution and most just. Now, I have met Palestinians who feel, they don't simply want to have equal rights to their colonizers. They want recognition of their historic ties to the land and of their future ties to it, and may decide, for example, that they would prefer to have the autonomy to build a Palestinian society separate from their colonizers. They may decide that as well. So it's really, again, not my decision. But in terms of the little I've learned, being as young as I am and involved in a few struggles, it seems to me that democracy and equal rights is a pretty simple basic we can have for whatever the future resolution turns out to be.
So more of the South African model, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is, if you look at South Africa today, I don't know that you can really argue that the integration worked, but one could perhaps argue that it's better than had they decided to have, let's say, one black state and one white state. I mean, I think that would probably have been even worse.
Right, which was what?
And that's what the two-state solution basically is.
Yes. So, Anna Balter, thank you so much for joining us. It's been really fascinating. One more time, you're going to be speaking Thursday night at Columbia University.
Exactly, at 8 p.m. in Hamilton Hall. And you can get all the details you'd like on my website, annainthemiddleeast.com. So it's A-N-N-A in the Middle East, all one word, .com. You can see the details of my schedule in New York City and surroundings, and also my book, Witness in Palestine, my DVD of the presentation I've given around the country. You can write me all kinds of good stuff. So check it out, annainthemiddleeast.com.
Okay, Anna, thanks so much. And we look forward to talking to you again. So we'll let let your voice recover for a few hours.
Thank
now.
You. Thank okay. you very much. Keep up the great work.
Thank you. You too. Good night.
All right. Bye.
Okay. All right. So let's see. We've got how much time do we have left? We've got around 5 minutes left. I've got one brief announcement, but maybe we should play a little bit more of Majida Al-Rumi.
Samra. Beautiful.
Okay, one brief announcement. Much as it hurts to have to turn down the golden voice of Mashida al-Rumi, 1 week from tonight, actually, Tuesday, October 21st, I am going to be at Andrew Kleiman's lecture on the economic meltdown, entitled Worse Than They Want You to Think, A Marxist Analysis of the Economic Crisis. And let's see, Andrew Kleiman is a professor of economics at Pace University and the author of Reclaiming Marx's Capital, A Refutation of the Myth of Inconsistency. And he's written two essays about the financial meltdown. One entitled Trying to Save Capitalism from Itself, and A Crisis at the Center of the System. And the first appeared on the MarxistHumanismToday.org website, and the other in the journal International Socialism. So I'm very curious to hear what he's going to be saying, and particularly his... it says that he will be drawing on Raya Dunayevskaya's theory of state capitalism in order to explain why the supposedly free market policymakers and economists are ushering in a new period of stratified property and state control of the economy, which sounds like will be very relevant indeed, given the...
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.